This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents Backroads by Tawny O'Dell. This book is read by Andrew Iden. For my sister, Bean. To Jennifer Robinson for being the first person to go to the mat for me. Thank you for your faith and outrage. To Liza Dawson, my genie in the bottle, for her counsel, wisdom, and sanity. Thank you for helping me realize my dream. To Molly Stern, lippy goddess and master of minutiae, for her passion and devotion to this book and its author. Also for her remarkable ability to always be right, so far. Thank you for your guidance. To Mike for his love and support through sleepless nights, dark days, and dictionaries in the fridge. A lesser man would have deserted the trench. To my sweet pea, Tirza, and my little man, Connor. Mommy loves you bigger than anyone. And finally, thank you to my mom for her constant assurance that I could be whatever I wanted to be, and to my dad for his steady insistence that what I should be is a writer.
Chapter 1. All those times me and Skip tried to kill his little brother Donnie were just for fun. I keep telling the deputies this, and they keep picking up their styrofoam cups of coffee and walking away, only to return a few seconds later and heave their fat butt cheeks onto the metal-topped table in front of me and flash me sad, weary stares that would be almost tender if they weren't filled with so much hatred. They tell me they don't care about Skip and Donnie. They're not interested in stuff I did when I was a kid. I'm 20 years old now. I will be tried as an adult. The words come out of their mouths in skull-flavored capital letters and hover against the fluorescent glare of the room. I reach out to touch them, but before I can, they melt away again, and one of the deputies slaps down my hands, stained the color of a dead rose. They won't let me wash them. They want to know about the woman. I laugh. Which woman? My life is lousy with women. All ages, shapes, sizes, and levels of purity. The dead woman in the abandoned mining office behind the railroad tracks, one of them says, making a face like he might puke. I close my eyes and picture it. The roof with gaping holes, the rotting floorboards scattered with broken window glass, rusted screws and bolts, and pieces of flattened iron that used to be part of something bigger a long time ago. When I finally took her there, she didn't ask me to sweep it out. She said she didn't want to change anything about it because she knew it was a special place for me. She said she loved the calm of decay and desertion that reigned there. She liked art, and sometimes the way she talked sounded like a painting. Rage starts building inside me, nicely and neatly, like a perfect pyramid of sticks being piled up for a fire. My hands start shaking and I sit on them so the police won't see. Me and Skip use the mining office for our secret hideout, I answer, smiling, while the blaze roars to life inside me. Soon I will be nothing but a blackened skeleton of ash that the slightest touch will cause to crumble, but no one on the outside will know. The deputies shake their heads and groan and snort at the mention of Skip. One of them kicks a folding chair across the room. Another one says, "The kid's in shock." The other one says, "We're not going to get anything relevant or coherent out of him tonight." I reach for those words too, and this time I get the side of my head smacked instead of my sticky hands. "You better start talking," the sheriff says, pausing to spit a brown bullet of chew into an empty coffee can before adding, "Son," to his suggestion. He's the only one here I know. I remember him from my mom's trial 2 years ago. He testified that she gave herself up willingly after shooting my dad. He smells like a wet couch. I do start talking, but all that comes out is the same stuff about me and Skip again. How we used to spend hours in the old mining office, eating bologna sandwiches and hatching our plans against Donnie. We called it secret, even though Donnie knew where we were. It was secret because he couldn't get to it. He was too little to make it up the hill and through the vicious undergrowth surrounding the place like nature's barbed wire. We came up with some great ones. Once we bent down a birch sapling and anchored it to the ground with a tent stake and tied a rope loop to it, then lured Donnie into the middle with a shiny foil-wrapped ho-ho. The tree was supposed to break free and fling him to his death by his ankles. But we realized too late we hadn't figured out a way to make it do this, and Donnie just finished the ho-ho and left. Another time, we spilled a bunch of marbles on the back porch steps and yelled at him to come outside. We had a box of Little Debbie oatmeal cream pies for him. He came tearing out of the house, but instead of slipping and falling on the marbles, he skidded to a stop and sat down and played with them. Another time, we promised him a box of Little Debbie Star Crunches if he would let us tie up his feet and hands and lay him on the railroad tracks. But they were freight tracks, the same ones that run by the old mine. And we all knew a train hadn't been down them since before we were born. Donnie got bored waiting to die and started wriggling toward home on his belly. Our most ingenious plan was probably the time we put a pack of Dolly Madison zingers beneath the open garage door, and we hid out with the garage door opener and clicked it on when Donnie sat down to eat. He didn't notice or didn't care about the heavy door grinding down toward his skull. We watched in amazement, unable to believe we were finally going to succeed. But I lost my nerve and ran and yanked him to safety. I saved him. I can't seem to make the police understand what this says about my character. That's the closest I ever came to murder, I explain. Up until my dad... The sheriff interrupts me. He doesn't want me to get into that again. He knows all about my mom and dad. Everybody does. It was in the papers and all over TV. He was the one who was there, he reminds me. Not me. I wasn't even home. He was the one who walked in and found my mom with a bucket of red sudsy water, calmly scrubbing the stains of her kitchen wallpaper, while her husband lay a foot away, stuck to the tile in a pool of tarry blood, staring right at her with hunting trophy eyes. He was the one who found my baby sister, huddled in one of the doghouses, with vomit all over her because she had cried so hard she made herself throw up. And Jody never even liked Dad. He was the one who watched Dad get zipped up into a body bag, not me. I never got to see him again. It was a closed casket funeral. I'm not sure why. Mom shot him in the back. It's been almost 2 years now, the sheriff reminds me. No one cares anymore. It's not relevant. Define relevant, I say. The deputy who keeps hitting me grabs me by the front of my dad's camouflage hunting jacket and pulls me out of my chair. He has big sweat stains under his armpits. 85 today. Hot for the first week of June. Tell us about the woman, he shouts at me. I don't know why they won't say her name. I guess they're waiting for me to say it. For me to admit I knew her. Well, of course I did. They know I did. He drops me back into my chair and, tried as an adult, appears in front of my eyes, bright and buzzing like neon. I don't know why I can't talk about her. Each time I open my mouth, something about Skip comes out, and he's not even my friend anymore. I always knew Skip would leave. His constant scheming never seemed a part of these quiet, wounded hills, the way Donnie's blind love of snack cakes did. Donnie will be here forever. I see him every morning on my way to work at the ShopRite, waiting on the side of the road for the school bus like a stump. Skip's away at college now, I say. I'm still staring at the words, so I don't see the fist coming. I feel the warmth of blood gush down my chin before I feel the pain. Bright red droplets spatter onto the front of Dad's coat, where her blood has already dried into a brown crust. They keep trying to make me take off the coat. People are always trying to make me. I hear the sheriff say, Jesus Christ, Bill, do you have to do that? I think the sheriff's up for re-election next year. I guess I'll be old enough to vote then if I want. Vote as an adult. I think I would probably vote against him, though. It's not that I dislike the guy. and I don't know anything about his stance on law enforcement issues, so I can't say I disagree with him. My vote would be based solely on smell. I touch my smashed nose and decide to tell them the truth. Who's to blame? Who's at fault? Who should be locked up? I have nothing to be afraid of anymore. What will I be giving up by losing my freedom? What will the world be giving up by losing me? I told her once I wasn't good at anything. She ran her thumb over my lips, raw from kissing her, and said survival was a talent. Chapter 2. When Skip left for college, he never even came around to say goodbye. I heard about it from Amber, who heard Donnie talking about it on the bus. He wrote me once during his whole first year at school. The next year, I didn't think he was going to write at all, but he finally did and invited me to come visit him. We both knew I wouldn't go, and that's why he asked. I read the letter a dozen times, then put it in my drawer with the Victoria's Secret catalogs I was always swiping from Amber's room. I made the mistake the next day of telling Betty about the letter. Betty loved it when I talked about Skip. She especially loved hearing about the times we tried to kill Donnie. I suppose I should have never told her that stuff in the first place. But she asked me to tell her a pleasant childhood memory once, and it was the only one that came to mind. She wanted to know how Skip's letter made me feel, and why I wouldn't consider going to visit him. I pulled my stare away from the window where blue-gray tree branches crawled against the white sky like the veins on Betty's thighs. I had tried not to notice, but she wore her skirts way too short for an old lady. I didn't look at her, but the fact that I had stopped staring out the window was a signal between us that I heard her question, but the answer to it was so obvious I wasn't going to say it out loud. "I think I know what you're going to say, but why don't you tell me anyway?" she said, smiling. "Treat me like I'm stupid." It was what she always said to try and get me to talk. One of her textbooks must have told her teenagers could never resist this invitation. "I have to work," I said finally. "This weekend?" "Yes." "Next weekend?" "Yes." "Every weekend?" I didn't say anything, and she leaned back in her chair. "Do you have any other reasons for not going?" I shifted around on the far end of the couch and tried to find something new in the room to look at. But nothing ever changed. Desk, window, chair, table with lamp, couch, table with box of Kleenex, door, Betty. She didn't even have a framed diploma or a bookcase here. I asked her about this once. I thought all shrinks had bookcases. And she said this wasn't her real office. It was just the place where she saw government cases. I could tell she regretted the way she said it, and I let her. "Who's going to watch Jody and Misty?" I said after a while. "Who watches them when you're at work?" "I'm talking about overnight." "Amber's old enough to watch them overnight?" "Amber," I snorted, and I was done talking. I went back to staring out the window, and Betty reached into her blouse and adjusted her bra strap when she thought I wasn't looking. "I'm going to assume from that reaction that you and Amber aren't getting along any better," she said, and let me stew for a minute. "Why do you think that is?" she asked. A crow landed in the parking lot outside and started trying to peel a flattened earthworm off the blacktop. Early March had been warm and fooled everyone into thinking spring was here. The ground thawed, worms woke up, girls got out their summer clothes. Every morning on my way to work, I drove past a yawning group of bare-legged ones in shorts and miniskirts, waiting for the school bus with Donnie the Stump. In the past, I would have slowed down and watched from my rearview mirror until they disappeared around a bend in the road. But lately, looking at girls shredded my nerves. It was a big part of becoming a man, discovering there was a difference between wanting sex and needing it. "Amber says she's been trying," Betty persisted. "She's told me she's been helping out a lot more around the house." "Are you kidding me?" I cried out. "No, I'm not. Do you disagree with that?" I laughed, a real laugh, a sincere har-dee-har-har. "Why would she tell me that if it isn't true?" Betty asked. I pulled one of my feet onto my lap and started digging at a piece of gravel stuck in the tread of my Sears work boot. Amber made fun of the red laces. I didn't care. They lasted forever, not like the Payless crap she bought with my money. Because along with being lazy and stupid, she's also a liar, I answered. How do I know she's the liar and not you? I got the gravel out and seriously thought about flicking it across the room at Betty. But instead I put it in the pocket of Dad's camouflage hunting jacket. I guess you don't, I said, feeling my face burn. I dropped my foot back on the carpet with a thud. I didn't mean to upset you. Sure you did. You want me to get mad, so I'll say something meaningful. I had made that mistake before. Recalling things like the way my mom's eyes had sparkled with tears at my 3-year-old observation that I am person-shaped, or how my mom used to save the dog's expired rabies tags because she thought they were pretty. I could always tell when I had accidentally said something meaningful, because Betty would look at me like I was suddenly naked and surprisingly well hung. She smiled and caught a piece of her nickel-colored hair with a finger and hooked it behind one ear. Her hair was expensive-looking, cut on an angle and shiny solid like a helmet. It didn't go with the rest of her. It reminded me of the country fair pony rides and the brand-new, freshly oiled saddles sitting on top of the broken-down, shaggy old ponies. Everything you say in these sessions is meaningful, Harley. I slumped down as far as I could go and still be on the couch. Can I go? Not yet. Let's try and resolve this problem. I think it would be good for you to get away for a day or two. If you don't trust Amber to watch your sisters overnight, what about someone else? A relative or neighbor? I told you before my mom doesn't have any family, and Dad's family won't have anything to do with us anymore. Why do you think that is? I guess because we're related to Mom. You're related to your father, too. Not as closely. She smiled at me again, and I fingered the gravel in my coat pocket and imagined it embedded smack in the middle of her forehead with a tiny trickle of bright red blood dripping from it. She would have gone right on talking if I did it. What about your Uncle Mike? I thought you said he's been helping out lately. He's been bringing me cases of Black Label. I guess that's helpful, although Rolling Rock would be more helpful in my opinion. She gave me her concerned look. Clear young eyes peering out anxiously from a wrinkled face like a kid trapped inside a mask. I hated it when old people kept something young about them. Like Bud, who bagged with me at the ShopRite and chewed bubblegum all the time. It was easier to think of them as always being old, instead of being young and dying very slowly. Alcohol is not a solution to your problems, Betty announced, frowning. I didn't say anything about alcohol, I'm talking about beer. If your social worker found alcohol on the premises, the girls would be put in foster homes immediately. You're underage. I don't care. You don't care if your sisters are put in foster homes? No. Well, you have a funny way of showing it. I have to go. I stood up and pulled my ready-mix concrete cap out of my back jeans pocket. Betty glanced at her watch and said, "We still have 15 minutes." I slapped the cap on my head and pulled the brim down to my eyes. My apologies to the taxpayers, I said, and headed out the door. The false spring had only lasted a week, and then, as if to punish the worms and the girls for their optimism, the weather had turned brittle cold. I blew in my hands and rubbed them together, then stuck them under my armpits while I walked quickly to my truck. I don't know why I was hurrying. The heater didn't work. The County Behavioral Health Services office was in the same long, low, brown brick building as the DMV and the Animal Control office. Across the intersection was the Eaton Park that had driven Denny's out of business. Even Grand Slam breakfasts couldn't compete with Eaton Park pies. And the strip mall with Blockbuster Video, Fantastic Sam's, the Dollar Tree, and a Chinese restaurant called Yee's. I always stopped at Yee's after my appointment with Betty. Jack Yee, the guy who owned the place, bobbed his head and smiled deliriously when I walked in, and his wife did the same, waving from a far corner where she always sat at a table reading a newspaper. I feared I was their best customer, and I only came in once a month and bought a $2 egg roll. Jack tried pushing the General Cho's chicken on me. Spicy, spicy, he said, grinning. No thanks, I told him, even though I was starving, and all I was going to get at home was blue box mac and cheese and hot dogs. It was Misty's night to cook. She was 12. He gave me Jody's umbrella and cookie for free and asked about her. He and his wife had only met her once, but they were blown away by her. They couldn't stop touching her hair. It fell all the way down to her butt and was the same color as the gold letters stamped on church hymnals. All the girls had long hair, including Mom. But Jody's was the most admired. Mom's was the reddest, Misty's the most neglected, Amber's the most likely to smell like a rank old blanket from the back of some guy's pickup truck. I took the little brown bag and sat it next to me in my truck, then spent the half-hour drive from Laurel Falls to Blacklick, watching the grease stain grow from the egg roll pressing against the paper. Wanted to eat it more than anything in life. I rolled down the window to try and get rid of the deep-fried smell, but I couldn't stand the cold. By the time I took the final bend leading home, I was driving so fast the old Dodge Ram was shuddering. Ours was the only house on Fairman Road, an unpaved 2-mile shortcut connecting two parts of a county road that doubled back on itself. Locals called it Potshot Road, because before my dad had started piecing together our house at the top of it, so many deer gathered in the clearing, any hunter hiding in the trees could take a pot shot and hit something. Every hunting season, Dad had to lock up the dogs in the garage, and Mom made us kids play inside for fear of getting shot. I never felt safer than those days Amber and I spent hiding beneath a blanket-covered card table playing war and listening to the crack of rifles outside and the calm, blasted silence that always followed. The deer had thinned out the past couple years, though. Even the stupidest animal could sense when a place had gone bad. The truck bounced over a rut, and the egg roll went flying off the seat onto the floor, where it landed on top of a bunch of empty fast-food coffee cups, crumbled McDonald's bags, and a cheap gray windbreaker with Barclays Appliances written across the back. One of Jody's dinosaurs was down there, too, and my parents' wedding picture. I had found the picture stuffed in the bottom of a garbage bag a couple months after the shooting. The sharp corner of the cheap yellow-gold frame had poked a hole through the plastic and scratched me on the calf while I was standing in my underwear putting on a twist tie. The rip got bigger, and garbage spilled out all over the kitchen floor, and I had froze, bracing myself for the flat of my dad's hand to connect with the base of my skull and for the tiny stars of light, like floating dandelion fuzz, to drift into my line of vision and pile up until I couldn't see anything but cold white nothingness. Then I remembered he was dead. The girls were all asleep, so I cleaned up the mess myself. I kept out the picture and was on my way to throw it in the outside can when something made me throw it in my truck instead. I never looked at it. Whenever I happened to notice it by accident, I buried it under the trash, but it always managed to surface again. Dad in a white suit and a glossy shirt patterned in jewel-toned splotches like a melted stained glass window, way too much hair and collar, a Burt Reynolds mustache, a blood-red carnation in his buttonhole, grabbing Mom around the waist and grinning drunkenly at one of his off-camera buddies. Mom, in a gauzy white handkerchief dress, a ton of eye makeup, long white feather earrings and ceramic Farrah hair, her shoulders kind of hunched together, and her head tilted away from Dad's breath, looking like she was trying not to throw up. I gave her a lot of morning sickness. I reached over with my foot and pushed the picture under the trash. The first half mile of our road was straight uphill, and the trees grew together over the top of it, making a tunnel of leaves in summer, and a tunnel of snow in winter, and a tent of bare branches like charred fingers the rest of the year. Our house sat at the crest. Across the road was the clearing, stretching out green and smooth, then disappearing over a slope into a rolling sea of hills the color of rust and soot and worn yellow carpet. The power lines and the smoke-belching twin coal stacks of the Keystone power plant in the distance were the only signs of humanity. Whenever people asked me how we could stand to stay in the house, I told them I liked the view. And then they thought I was even crazier than before they asked. Aside from Laurel Falls National Bank, the The only thing that could have driven me away was the sight of the four empty doghouses. Every time I parked my truck and was greeted with silence instead of the barking chorus I had come to expect ever since I was old enough to put meaning to sound, I hated myself for failing them. But dog food costs a fortune. I managed to find homes for three, and kept Elvis, my shepherd mutt. He was allowed to come inside now, but he was nervous about it. So were the girls. If anything could have brought my dad raging back from the dead, it would have been the sight of a dog lying in the middle of his living room. Misty opened the front door and let Elvis out. She followed him and stood on the front porch, silent and expectant, fingering the pink rhinestones on the grimy cat collar she wore around her wrist. The collar had belonged to the kitten Dad got her for her 10th birthday. It only survived for 2 months before we found it shot in the woods. I remembered Mom taking the death harder than anyone. She burst into tears when she saw what was left of the blood-matted, fluffy white carcass Misty had dragged back to the yard by its tail. She folded Misty into her arms and held her while Misty stood stiffly and stared at the body with her eyes glazed brown like a medicine bottle. Then she knelt down and slowly unbuckled the collar and fastened it around her wrist while Mom's hands still clutched her shoulders. Later, Mom said she had been in shock. "Did you get my egg roll?" Misty called out, rubbing her thin, bare arms at her sides and her stockinged feet against each other. I threw the bag. Elvis stopped in his tracks on his way to meet me and watched its flight. It fell on the frozen mud next to the steps, and he bounded over to sniff it. Misty glanced at me, unsmiling, before she walked down to get it. I couldn't tell if she was pissed or hurt or couldn't care less. Her mask of freckles gave her the appearance of being more persecuted than she really was. I started across the yard and paused at the patch of cement with a sawed-off piece of pipe sticking from it where Dad's satellite dish used to be. I tapped at it with the toe of my boot and reminded myself I needed to get rid of the rest of the pipe before someone got hurt on it. The dish had gone the way of the dogs, leaving us with only four channels. Jody lost Disney, Misty lost Nickelodeon, Amber lost MTV and Fox. At the time, they had all been too depressed about Mom and Dad to care, but now they weren't, and I had to hear about it every day. I went inside and wiped my boots on the mat by the door, but I didn't take them off the way I used to have to. "Did you get my fortune cookie and umbrella?" Jody asked from the living room. On my way through, I told her Misty had the bag. I tossed the stuffed dinosaur over the back of the couch, and Jody's head popped up from the cushions. "Sparkle Threehorn," she cried. "I lost him." "I know, I found him."
"Where?"
"My truck." The head disappeared, and the couch said,
"Thanks."
I walked into the kitchen and found the Thursday pot of boiling water on the stove, and five hot dogs laid out on a paper plate ready for nuking in the microwave. I opened a cupboard and grabbed a bag of pretzels. Misty came in after me, eating her egg roll. I hadn't noticed from a distance that she was wearing some of Amber's purple eyeshadow again. Mom wouldn't have approved of her wearing makeup already, but I had surrendered control of everything female to Amber the day Misty came to me the year before and told me she was pretty sure she had started her period. I looked at the hot dogs again and did the math. One for Jody, one for Misty, three for me. "Isn't Amber eating?"
"She's got a date."
"What?" Misty tore open the Kraft box, pulled out the cheese packet, and dumped the macaroni in the pan. The water foamed up and she adjusted the heat.
"She said you'd be mad, but I can watch Jody. I'm old enough."
"That's not the point."
"I know. Amber said the main reason you'd want her to stay home is because you want to ruin her fun, not because of the babysitting."
I threw the bag on the counter and pretzels spilled onto the floor.
Elvis lunged for them as I stormed out.
Misty pushed one aside with a blue-polished big toe and kept stirring the pot. I pounded on Amber's door so hard her Indian dream catcher fell off the wall. She was holding it in her hand when she opened the door. She had on a red lace bra and hip-hugger jeans, and her pinched expression of annoyance changed into a satisfied smile when she saw me looking at her. "You're supposed to watch the kids tonight," I yelled at her over the music blaring from her radio. She turned her back on me and walked with exaggerated hip thrusts over to her dresser, the top of her hummingbird tattoo peeking at me over the waistband of her jeans. He seemed to be waving a green wing at me. She grabbed a brush and bent over. "Misty's 12. She can babysit a 6-year-old," she said upside down, from behind a curtain of reddish-blonde hair. "They shouldn't be alone in the house late at night," I said. "What is your problem? Why is it okay to leave them alone during the day and not at night? I swear you're afraid of the dark." She finished and stood up, tossing her hair behind her with her throat arched and exposed, a female gesture that always cut right through me. I stood at the doorway, not wanting to go in. Every inch of wall space and ceiling was covered with tie-dyed scarves and pieces of sheets done mostly in purples and blues. Her only window was hung with strings of midnight blue, star-shaped beads. The shelves behind her bed were packed with psychedelic colored candles, most of them lit. The combination of the colors and the dim lighting gave the place a half-digested feel. I walked through it quickly and arrived at her stereo sitting on a cinderblock shelf next to a stack of glamour magazines worth at least 200 pounds of dog food. I turned off the radio. She threw her brush back onto her dresser in protest, where it clattered against all her makeup and hair stuff. "What is your problem?" "I can't hear." "No, I mean, what is your problem?" she said again, rolling her empty blue eyes at me. "Did Betty Weddy tell her Harley Warley he needs to have more respect for himself? Did she tell him he needs to get more respect from his girls?" She made a kissy face. I didn't say anything. "I don't need to stay home tonight," she added, and pulled a tiny striped sweater out of her drawer that looked like something a schnauzer might get for Christmas. Amazingly, she squeezed her head into it, and the fabric expanded, first taking on the shape of her face, then the shape of her breasts. She got me staring at her again and smiled triumphantly. "Admit it," she said. "You just hate the idea that I have a life and you don't." "Define life," I said. The smile flickered and went out. She retrieved her brush and gave her head a few vicious strokes, then started lightly slapping it against the palm of her hand the way Dad used to do with Mom's wooden cooking spoon before he took off after one of us. "You know what your problem is? You're pissed off because you have to work. Well, you'd have to work anyway. It's not like you'd be going to college or hanging out with friends or doing anything meaningful. You don't even watch TV." I laughed, even though I wasn't feeling the least bit humorous. "Meaningful," I repeated. "Like fucking guys in the back of pickup trucks." The brush flew out of her hand and hit me in the arm. "You'd give anything to fuck someone," she hissed at me. I wanted to pick up the brush and beat Amber senseless with it. I wanted to put big red welts on her pretty face and make blood gush from her ears. Not because I hated her, not because she deserved it, not because I wanted to make her fear me. Simply because it would feel good. This must have been the same way Dad used to feel before he belted me, and I took some comfort in realizing the desire to hurt someone was nothing personal. The difference between Dad and me was that he always went ahead and hit one of us, and he was a much happier person. I knew it never occurred to Amber that I might hurt her. She believed violence was an act of strength, and she thought I was weak. Otherwise, she would never have risked pushing me like she did. She hated getting hit. I picked up her brush and gave it back to her. For a moment, we both held on to it, and I felt it tremble. She went back to preparing for her date. I went to get ready for work. Amber had the best room in the house, mine. She used to have to share with Misty until Jody came along. Then she got my room and I got kicked into the basement. I didn't want to go, and I never bothered to try and make the place homey. A twin bed with a naked light bulb hanging over it, a chest of drawers, a stereo, a coat of leftover green bathroom paint on one of the cement walls, a square of purple shag carpet, and a couple of mouse traps were the only signs of life down here. Most nights I lay on my back and imagined what it would feel like if the light bulb crashed down on my forehead and a needle of glass pierced my eyeball or got in my mouth and I swallowed it. Skip used to say if someone got a glass sliver under his skin and didn't take it out right away, it would get into his bloodstream and travel to his heart and kill him. We tried killing Donnie that way once. There was a ton of broken glass around the old mining office. But Donnie wouldn't let us stick the glass in him, not even for a tasty cake jelly crimpet. If the bulb ever did break and a sliver did kill me, I'd want to be buried with the white glass shards all over my face. People would think they were white rose petals unless they got up close. I pulled the string and the light came on after a couple sputters. In a day or two, I was going to pull the string and the bulb was going to die with a hollow pop. I didn't know where Mom kept the new ones. When she went off to prison, she took all sorts of secret domestic knowledge with her. What drawer the envelopes were in. How to make jello jigglers. Which bubble bath brand made the longest lasting bubbles. Who was allergic to what, and who was afraid of what. Closest I ever came to asking her for help was the time I needed the cupcake pan to make cupcakes for Jody's school birthday party. It had already been a year and a half since Mom's sentencing, and I hadn't heard anything from her outside of secondhand messages through the girls. Not a single phone call, card, or letter. Not a single attempt to mastermind a jailbreak, or mount an appeal, or tell her story to Oprah. Of course, she hadn't heard anything from me either. I knew it was stupid for both of us to be sitting around blaming each other for abandoning each other and trying to figure out who did it first. It wasn't any different from asking which came first, the chicken or the egg, knowing full well it didn't matter because God had to come before either one of them. But no matter how hard I tried, I just couldn't see any reason to keep up a relationship with her. She wasn't ever getting out. She was done being our mother. I understood that completely from the moment I saw her take a seat in the back of the sheriff's car with a serene, slumped relief, like she was going off to bed after a particularly long day. The part I still didn't get was why. It turned out Misty knew where the cupcake pan was and spared me from making the phone call to Mom. Misty used to bake blueberry muffins in it for Dad all the time. Mom wouldn't do it for him because she knew he was going to smother them in butter, and she worried about his cholesterol level. She told me once she envied women who lived back in the good old days, who only had to worry about Indians and mountain lions killing their husbands, something about those things being beyond a wife's control. I changed into the black pants and polo shirt I had to wear at ShopRite, put my dad's coat back on, yanked off the light, and started bounding up the stairs two at a time. Then I turned around and went back for Skip's letter and stuffed it in my pocket. Misty was already eating. Jody had a full plate, but she was busy writing in her red notebook covered with stickers. About 20 dinosaurs were lined up on her side of the table. Sparkle Threehorn sat in a place of honor in the very middle with the fortune cookie. Elvis whined and scratched from outside the back door. I reached for the loaf of Town Talk. "No buns?" I asked. "We're out," Misty said. "Why aren't you eating?" I asked Jody. I slapped three slices of bread on my plate, put a hot dog in the middle of each, squirted mustard and ketchup on them, rolled them up, and was done eating two before Jody answered me. "I'm making my list of things to do. I don't like hot dogs anyway." "Since when?" Misty asked. "Since always. You always eat hot dogs." "Not like that." We all looked at her Lion King plate and her hot dog cut into pennies and the puddle of ketchup she dunked them in. "I like them long now," she said. "Esme says cut-up hot dogs are the number one cause of choking deaths among children in the United States. She wasn't sure about the world. She told me on the bus today." "Live dangerously," Misty replied. "I won't eat it." "You have to." "I do not." "Harley," Misty commanded me. "Tell her she's got to eat it." "I don't care if she eats it," I said, and emptied the pan of macaroni and cheese onto my plate.
"I'll eat it if you fix it."
"How am I going to fix it?"
Misty asked, narrowing her eyes until they became two purple slits in her speckled face.
"With glue,"
Jody stated, in all seriousness. I smiled across the table at her. She cracked me up sometimes. Misty looked back and forth between the two of us.
"Eating glue will kill you," she instructed us.
"Then make me another one," Jody asked.
"I don't want to."
"Make me another one. Eat Harley's last one."
"No way, I want it," I said.
"Trade with her," Misty said.
Jody looked at my hot dog skeptically.
"There's mustard on it," she said. "Wipe it off."
Misty's hand suddenly shot out. She grabbed my last hot dog, scraped off the bread and mustard with her blue fingernails, and plunked it down in front of Jody. Then she picked up Jody's plate and dumped the sliced hot dog onto mine. Jody studied the situation for a moment, then gave Misty a shit-eating grin and asked her for a juice box. Misty stared back at her blankly, the lack of expression on her face betraying a storm of emotion underneath.
"We don't have any," she said slowly. "Then I want milk."
"Get it yourself."
"I can't pour the big jug. I always spill."
I closed my eyes and imagined picking up the empty pan and swinging it with all my might, catching Jody in the head first, knocking her off her chair, and then hitting Misty and watching her spit up bloody macaroni and cheese. Instead, I went and poured Jody a glass of milk and brought it to her. As I sat down, her list caught my eye. Feed dinosaurs. Color picture for mommy. Go to school. Go to prison. Watch TV. Pray for daddy's soul. Go to bed. I hadn't told her yet that I wasn't going to take her to see mom tomorrow. Our last visit had been 3 months before, but I still wasn't ready to brave another drive home. They were always the same. All four of us crammed into the cab of my truck, Jody crying, Misty telling her to shut up, and Amber swearing at me because I wouldn't go in and see mom. Jody's handwriting reminded me of a map mom had drawn as a kid to help her find her way back home to Illinois after an ancient great aunt and uncle she had never met before drove her to Pennsylvania, where she was going to live from then on because her mom and dad and infant brother had been killed in a car accident. Mom only showed me her map once. I was having problems with a map of my own I had found in a school library book, traced, and brought home. The book claimed the map would work starting from any kid's bedroom, and I spent days trying to figure out how to get to the amazing dragon-shaped island crowded with volcanoes spewing rainbow-colored lava. Finally, I gave up and went to Mom with it. She took me to her room and let me crawl up on her bed while she went and got her Bible out of her top dresser drawer. Mom read the Bible a lot, but she never went to church. She said she didn't like Christians. She brought it over and held it out to me, holding it closed, and let me run my thumb along the scarlet-edged pages the way I always did. Squeezed together, the pages looked and felt like a red satin ribbon, but apart they sliced like razors. She turned to the back and took out a folded piece of paper. "This is what you call an antique," she said, smiling. "I drew it when I was about the age you are now. That's about 18 years ago." She opened it up. It was a crayon drawing beginning at a yellow house, detailed with a pink roof and ruffled curtains, and a flower garden, and a tree with a smiling squirrel. Then a stark, straight black line cut across the paper until it suddenly broke off into a downward angle and ended at nothing. On top of the line was written, Highway 80. "Maps," she explained while I studied it, "only work if the place you were trying to get to exists." I felt Jody's grip on my wrist. She tugged on my arm, and I saw Mom's quiet insistence in her face, a look that used to make me want to do my best or act my worst depending on how strong I felt at the moment. She asked me if I wanted to hear her fortune. "I've got to go to work," I told her. "Tell me tomorrow."
"No,"
she said. She let go of me, cracked open the cookie, and gently pulled out the strip of paper. "Worry is the interest you pay on trouble before it's due," she said, smiling up at me. "Great," I said. Elvis almost knocked me over when I stepped outside. I kicked him out of the way and got in the truck, turned on the radio good and loud, and locked both doors. I wasn't afraid of the dark. I was respectful of it. Out here, it was so thick it swallowed headlight beams. I tried to make my mind a blank during the drive, but Jody's list kept popping into it, and Skip's letter, and Amber fucking some guy in the back of a pickup truck. By the time I swung my truck into the ShopRite lot, I had worked myself into a fairly foul mood. Fortunately, weeknights were dead ever since the 24-hour Super Walmart had gone up. I knew people who did their grocery shopping there at 3 a.m., just because they could. I parked and put my keys inside Dad's coat pocket and found Skip's letter. Against my better judgment, I took it out and read it again. And right in the middle of Skip's description of his fraternity, I suddenly realized our entire friendship had only happened because we were two boys who lived within walking distance of each other and nobody else. Funny how something like that only occurred to a person during his lowest moments. I couldn't have figured it out when I was happy. Chapter 3. Like I said, I was in a bad mood. Fortunately, ShopRite was empty by 9 o'clock. No more mumbling, have a nice night, to customers who didn't care what I wished for them anyway. Usually I snuck off the first chance I got and went and stocked shelves, so I didn't have to listen to the cashiers talk about every unemployed husband and ovarian cyst in the tri-state area. When I first took the job, me and my family were a hot topic of discussion, especially around Mom's trial. Sometimes I thought that was the only reason I was finally able to get someone to hire me.
Most employers looked at me as coming from an unstable family environment and didn't want me around, which cracked me up because the only difference between my environment and everyone else's around here was that mine had been revealed on the 11 o'clock news. I think Rick, the manager here, saw me as a way to get his fat face on TV. He had visions of reporters in short skirts and high heels saying, "I'm standing here with Rick Rogers, manager of the ShopRite, where convicted husband killer Bonnie Altmer's son works." And he saw me as a drawing card for new customers. People would come by to get a look at me, and then have to buy something so that it didn't seem like jerks. I didn't know what they thought they were going to see. A slobbering mental case? A guy who broke down and cried every couple minutes? Either way, I was a freak show. But it was better to be a freak with a paycheck than one on welfare, so I jumped at the ShopRite job. A couple months later, I got a job at Barclays Appliances, too. It was tough knowing everybody was staring at me and whispering behind my back, but I preferred the gossip over direct confrontation. The worst was when people tried to talk to me about it, and they were always women. Some were well-intentioned, but most were looking for a phone conversation to have with their girlfriends that night. I never knew what to say to them. Sometimes I was tempted to tell them what really happened. One day, you're a guy who's happy he managed to survive high school and get that almighty piece of paper, and you're thinking you might try to get a job at Ready Mix Concrete, where your dad's worked since the beginning of time, or maybe Sharp Pavement. Good pay and good bennies, your dad's always telling you. Blue Cross, Blue Shield, none of that HMO crap. Good pension plan, good workman's comp. He knew a guy who threw out his back moving his brother-in-law's pool table and blamed it on a job pouring a 7-Eleven and got full pay for 3 months of couch time. In the meantime, it's summer, and the hills are every shade of green, and you can take your dog and walk for miles and not see another living soul. And if it gets too late, you can sleep on the ground and wake up covered in dew, surrounded by sparkling grass and the smell of wet dirt and wet dog. On those mornings, you try not to think about the rest of the world. You try not to think about the fascinating lives people lead on TV and how even bad shit seems exciting on TV and better than what you're doing. You try not to think about the models in your sister's Victoria's Secret catalogs and how you will never have a woman who even remotely resembles one of them. You try not to think about how you will probably never have any woman and how the one shot you had, you messed up so bad you don't even want to think about trying again, yet all you can think about is trying again. You try not to think about how you're about to lose your only friend to college, how you've already lost a sister to puberty. You try not to think about the fact that you're 18 years old and people are always telling you you've got your whole life ahead of you, but you already feel like you've done all the living there is to do around here, and you're too much of a chicken shit to go somewhere else. But at least you've got a family you can stand, even if they are all sisters. And at least you've got two parents, two married parents living in the same house with you. One day you're that guy, and the next day, you're assigned a social worker and a therapist, and given the choice of either being a legal adult with three dependents or an orphan with nobody. Sometimes I felt like telling them this, but I knew they would think it was boring. Only three baggers worked weeknights, and we were too many. Rick knew this and always scheduled me with Bud in church because they couldn't handle busy hours. They were agonizingly slow. Bud because he was old and never shut up, and church because he was retarded.
A lot of people didn't like that word, but it was the word church preferred, so I used it too. He hated terms like handicapped and challenged and special because he wasn't any of those things in his opinion. He had looked up the word retard in a dictionary once and was pleasantly surprised to find out it was a verb and not a noun. The definition said, to delay the progress of, and he felt this described imperfectly.
Like when cars slowed down for a PennDOT crew, he had carefully explained to me, using a can of green giant baby peas as a visual aid.
I understood. He didn't think of himself as a complete stop. Church had a difficult time stocking shelves. He questioned the placement of every product, and Bud had arthritis in his knees. But I loved a straightforward task I couldn't possibly screw up. I loved wheeling out a stack of boxes into a quiet, deserted aisle and filling up empty space. And I never thought twice about why the bouillon cubes were with the condiments and not the soups, and if the Cheez-Its were more snack than cracker or more cracker than snack. I told Church he was going to drive himself crazy dwelling on other people's biases. I slipped away from the registers and left Bud talking to the cashiers and Church sitting on his bench picking at a scab on one of his knobby elbows. On my way to the storeroom, I counted 3 shoppers. None of them were near the pet food aisle, so I loaded my dolly with 8-pound bags of meow mix and set off. I was heading past canned vegetables and ethnic foods when I saw a woman in jeans and a short gray sweater pushing her cart slowly along the shelves. At first, I thought she might have been more of a girl. I hoped she was, because then I might have been able to get up the nerve to talk to her. She was perfect from behind. I stopped and watched. She was swaying her head back and forth, sort of keeping time with the sway in her walk. I couldn't tell if she was grooving to the song on the light FM station Rick made us play. I hoped not. It was Muskrat Love. She stopped in front of the Chinese food and reached for a soy sauce on the top shelf. And while I was staring at the section of exposed skin right above her jeans where her sweater had pulled up, I realized she was Esme's mom. I felt my face flush and checked around to make sure no one had seen me. Then I remembered no one could see my thoughts. The Mercers lived about 2 miles east from where Potshot met Blacklick Road, making them our second closest neighbors next to Skip's family. There were 4 of them: Esme, her little brother Zach, her dad, and her mom, Callie. This wasn't the first time I had noticed Callie Mercer's body. I saw her here at the store now and then, whenever Jody played with Esme and I had to pick her up afterward. She had brought us a lasagna the day of Dad's funeral, and a stuffed chicken the day of Mom's sentencing. And she used to come by the house to check up on us, but eventually Amber's hostility and my total lack of conversation skills put an end to that. I even discussed her with Skip once. The summer of our senior year, we were out walking the railroad tracks and decided to cut across her property, and we saw her splashing in the creek with her kids in a pair of soaked cutoffs and a pink bikini top, and I breathed out, "Look at that." Skip thought I was joking. He said I was sick. He said wanting to nail someone's mother was like wanting to nail your cousin. I told him if she walked over here and pressed her wet shorts against him and whispered in his ear that she wanted to fuck him, he would shoot off in his pants before he could say anything back. He gave me a strange look and said I was really sick. "Hi, Harley." She had spotted me. Not that I minded, but I never knew what to say to her. I wasn't sure if I should talk to her like she was Esme's mom, or Mrs. Mercer with a lasagna, or a chick in a pink bikini top. "Hi," I said back. "How have you been?" She asked in a softly urgent voice that made me feel like she had been looking for the answer to this question for days. "Okay. The girls? Okay." She smiled a little. "Jody told Esme you won't let Amber get her driver's permit." Just the mention of Amber driving made me want to kick something, but I tried to stay reasonable. "I told her she can get it once she gets a job and can pay for her own insurance," I explained angrily. "The insurance company's going to put her on my policy the minute she gets her license, whether I let her drive my truck or not, just because we live in the same house. It's like $1,000. "Harley," she laughed and touched my shoulder. "You're great," she said. I didn't know what that meant, but it made the anger melt away. and my mouth feel dry. You have definitely become a full-fledged head of the household, she said, still smiling. Esme's been bugging me to invite Jody over for dinner again. I was thinking about Monday. Would that be okay with you? Monday was Jody's night to cook, but I guess we could all pour our own bowls of cereal.
Sure,
I said. She added a can of bamboo shoots and a packet of dried mushrooms to her cart. I must have been looking at her funny because she smiled again and explained that she was going to make hot and sour soup. Do you like Chinese food? She asked, her voice full of stirring sincerity again. I pictured her writing down my responses to all her questions so she could pull them out later and remember them fondly. Yeah, I said. Well, the recipe makes a ton. I'll send some home with Jody for you. She tucked a few stray brown curls behind one ear. She had most of her hair pulled back in a clip, but it was thick and wild, and always looked messed up no matter how she wore it. I'm having the best time shopping tonight, she said, sounding astonished by her own words. What? No kids. I left them at home with Brad. Right. She gave me another big smile and brought both hands together in front of her, clenched into fists, like she was begging for something. Then she slowly spread her fingers like the opening of a paper fan. It's so wonderful shopping by myself and shopping at this hour. There's nobody else here. It's the most relaxing thing I've done in weeks. Her eyes traveled appreciatively over the shelves as if she had just discovered an art behind food placement. God, that sounds pathetic, coming to a grocery store for kicks. It's not as pathetic as working in one, I said. Her smile disappeared with a stricken suddenness that made me think the condition might be permanent. The hands closed up like dying flowers. She plucked them from the air and shoved them into her jeans pockets. It's a lot more pathetic, she said, her voice hardening from a liquid to a solid. I had to finish up, she added. If I take too long, Brad will be pissed when I get home, and then the whole reason for going by myself in the first place will have been wasted. Sure, I said, nodding. Remember to send a note with Jody on Monday so she can get off the bus with Esme. Okay. Bye, she said. Bye. I wheeled on past, in a sort of shock at the unexpected transformation in her. I thought only kids acted that way, deliriously happy one minute, deeply depressed the next over stuff nobody else cared about. I hated myself for ruining her good mood. After a while, I thought about taking a break from stocking and going back to the registers so I'd be there when she checked out, but I wouldn't have been able to talk to her in front of the other people, and even if I had been able to talk to her, I probably would have made things worse. When I did finally wander up front, she was long gone. Bud was talking to the cashiers about a rabid skunk he had spotted staggering around his place that morning. That warm spell woke everything up too early, he told them. One nodded her agreement and said, I must have passed 4 dead groundhogs on the side of the road today.
There was a dead cat by our house once, Church interrupted from where he sat on the bench. My mom said not to touch it.
I walked over and sat down beside him. He turned his head toward me and settled his small gray eyes on me. He wore the thickest glasses I had ever seen. Sometimes I wondered if he really needed them, or if some cruel doctor had prescribed them for him just because he was retarded and they completed the look.
My mom said not to touch it, he repeated for my benefit.
That's good advice, I said.
So, did you shoot it?
The other cashier asked Bud.
Hell no,
he said, blowing a quick pink bubble and snapping it back inside his mouth with a loud crack.
I'm not going to shoot a skunk and stink up the whole hill.
But you said it was rabid.
Harley,
he called over to me.
Would you shoot a rabid skunk?
The question had barely left his lips before the two cashiers realized the potential for scandal by mentioning guns around me. They both perked up and gave me their full attention, something I could never get them to do when I had a question about a price check. I didn't know what they expected me to say.
No, but I'd shoot a family member. Or,
come on, bud, you know the sheriff's department confiscated all my dad's guns after my mom used his Remington to blow a hole through him. Someday I was going to give them what they wanted. I guess not, I said. Church slapped his skinny thigh like I had just told the best joke in the world. I watched his face and saw his whole unavoidable life summed up in its parts. The flecks of spit sprang from his mouth when he laughed, the zits on his chin, the scar on his forehead where a kid had thrown a Tonka truck at him in second grade, the smooth gray eyes rolling around behind the glasses like pebbles in a jar.
"That's telling 'em, Harley," he hooted.
I envied him. The house was dark when I got home. No one had thought to leave the porch light on for me, but I didn't care. I remembered once getting into an argument with my mom about her not leaving the light on for my dad on the nights he stayed out drinking. I told her a man driving up to his own house at night deserved to see a light burning no matter what he had done. She said if the man had done something that needed forgiving, a burning porch light was the last thing he wanted to see. At the time, I disagreed with her, but now I understood what she meant. He didn't want to be reminded he had dependents. Elvis came flying out of the woods at the sound of my truck door slamming shut. He ran up, put his paws on my chest, and sniffed me all over. Sometimes I brought him scraps from the meat case. He gave up and followed me to the house, hovering for a second in the doorway as if he still expected one of Dad's boots to catch him in the chest. Then he came inside. Mom's shears on the front window were getting snagged and ripped around the bottom from him jumping on them. Misty was asleep on the couch, with a TV show flickering across her face. An empty Mountain Dew can and an open bag of barbecued chips were spilled on the floor. I went and got a beer out of the fridge and collapsed on the end of the couch near her feet and tried to watch some TV, but I got bored. I took Skip's letter out of my dad's coat pocket, opened it again, and searched out the part where he said he'd been laid by two different girls since he'd been at school. I believed him. I was only a girl a year, and he did okay with girls. He wasn't a virgin when he went away. He had a girlfriend for a while during our junior year. She was a friend of Brandy Crow's, the girl I almost made it with. Brandy was married already. I had seen her wedding picture in the Laurel Falls Gazette a month before. A Valentine's Day wedding. She and her husband probably lay in bed at night after a successful screw and made fun of me. The only guy in America who didn't know how to use a rubber correctly. I didn't care. He was from Penn's Ridge, and they were all a bunch of grass-chewing rednecks over there. The night I messed up with Brandy, I went and slept at the old mining office. I couldn't stand the thought of going back to my basement bed unchanged, when I had seriously believed I was going to return physically and spiritually altered. I stretched out right on top of the broken glass and rusted bolts, and didn't feel any of it. The humiliation had made me numb. I woke up once in the middle of the night to the smell of rotting wood and bologna and yellow mustard, but I must have imagined the sandwich part. A huge white moon shone through the ragged tears in the roof and covered me in this eerie silver glow, and made me think about my mom reading from her Bible at Christmas, about the angel Gabriel showing up at the Virgin Mary's house and explaining how the Holy Ghost was going to come upon her and the power of the highest was going to overshadow her, and then she would be pregnant with Christ. Each year when Mom read that to me, I pictured a serenely beautiful naked girl, bathed in the same kind of silver, her eyes big and scared, but her lips smiling. God crawling all over her, but she thinks it's moonlight. The moonlight was what drove me back home that night. I didn't want God on me, even by accident. I folded Skip's letter and put it back in my pocket. Then closed my eyes and allowed myself one quick fantasy about horny college chicks, before finishing my beer and going out back to make sure the garbage can lid was locked against the raccoons. Waking a hibernating bear was easier than waking Misty. I didn't even bother trying, and scooped her up like a bride and carried her to her bed. I laid her down, and her arm wearing the cat collar slid off and dangled. I picked up her hand and placed it on her chest. She still had bread and mustard caked beneath her fingernails. Her side of the room had changed a lot the past year. She had packed away most of her stuffed animals and all of her Barbie dolls. A Spice Girls poster had replaced the one of galloping horses, and her dresser top was littered with nail polish and lipsticks now, instead of toy ponies with pink and purple hair. A framed photo of her and Dad sat on the nightstand between her bed and Jody's. The two of them were smiling next to a wide-eyed, gutted buck lying tangle-laid across the hood of the Dodge.
was Misty's first clean kill. She had turned the picture completely around to face her side. I noticed a folded scrap of paper tucked behind it. I picked it up and recognized Jody's painstaking, boxy letters. "It's against the laws of nature." I smiled and turned it over to see if she had written anything else. It sounded like a controversy involving her dinosaurs. I looked over at her.